Welcome to Tony TV. Inspiring people across the planet to be a little kinder and a little more gentle with each other. Delivering inspirational TV, one story at a time, from my lounge to yours. I'm your host, Tony Lontis. And good morning, Australia. Well, lunchtime for Australia. Good evening, America. You're listening to your host, Tony Lontis, live on Radio Tony, and this is Everyday Business. And I am super excited about today's show because I get to talk to a gentleman by the name of Aaron Krenenbrough. And Aaron is a former AUSTRAC Senior Intelligence Analyst with 12 years experience in financial crime, economics, and education. While at AUSTRAC, intelligence produced by Aaron led to several significant operational outcomes. That's arrests, convictions, asset forfeitures, civil penalties, and disruptions. Then, in August 2019, Aaron founded AML Risk Solutions, and their mission is to help support and educate the industry to better understand the anti-money launder, counter-terrorism financing, and financial crime risks that they face. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Tony. Thank you for having me on the show.
I was super excited when I started researching what Aaron does and what his story is. And so I want to get straight into it. Can you tell the listeners what AUSTRAC is and what it does?
Of course. So AUSTRAC is one of Australia's 10 national intelligence community agencies. Work with the likes of the Australian Federal Police, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, which would be the equivalent probably of the DEA in the USA, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, and Australia's Secret Intelligence Service, which is kind of like the James Bonds. So what they do is they provide to the National Intelligence Community, or the NIC, what's called specialist financial intelligence. Now, that's not just tracing money and money movements. It means understanding the entities and the people behind the money and what they're doing.
So pretty important stuff for governments, both in Australia and across the world, I'm assuming.
Extremely important. So in Australia alone, I guess the estimate from the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission a few years ago was that serious and organised crimes like human trafficking and drug trafficking, they're costing our economy about $50 billion a year. Now, to put that figure, it's massive. Now, put that in context. Last financial year, I think we spent, the Australian government anyway, just under $21 billion on schools. So this is money coming out of your pocket, my pocket, you know, that it's, you know, straight into the pockets of criminals.
So, Aaron, were you always interested in crime and solving crimes, or did it come, how did that work for you? Because, like, for myself, I'm fascinated by crime and how crime works. Having been a victim of some pretty nasty things, it still fascinates me. It fascinates me how a criminal's mind works and how they perpetrate the crimes that they do. That I find that fascinating. And I don't find it morbid. I actually found it really interesting. So what got you into the sector?
I actually kind of fell into it. I started my career as a school teacher, believe it or not. And then I moved into to government, mostly in economics and policy before I moved into intelligence. Yeah. And I guess it started as a job and sort of a fascination, but it very quickly sort of evolved into a passion.
So is there, do you guys, like, we have the vision of people solving crime and the joy that they get, or the satisfaction they get. Is it the same for financial crimes as well, Aaron?
Oh, absolutely. There's no better feeling when you do get the feedback that you've provided intelligence that's led to a serious outcome or the disruption of a criminal network or even an arrest or a conviction. I mean, the ever elusive conviction. It feels fantastic. It makes you feel like you're making a real difference in this world.
Yeah. So, in terms of money laundering laws and money laundering in general, can you explain to our listeners what is money laundering and why is it important that we catch the people that do it?
Of course, yeah. So the meaning is in the name. So laundering,
Yes.
like going and doing your laundry. So it's about cleaning money or cleaning dirty money,
Uh-huh.
to put it
Yep.
metaphorically. Effectively, what it is that when criminals earn money through whatever crime
Yes.
they're committing, be it,
Uh-huh.
drug trafficking or human trafficking,
Yeah.
or, tax evasion or various different forms of, criminal crimes for profit, you
Yes.
can't just put that in your bank account. Someone's going to ask questions. You'll have the police knocking on your
Yeah.
door, and you'll be
Yeah.
arrested very quickly. So what they do is they hire, generally these very intelligent career criminals, some of
Yes.
which actually work within the legitimate financial sector, to create structures and create methods of hiding the source of their money, making it look legitimate,
Yes.
so that they can
Yeah.
then spend it and enjoy their profit without fear of the police coming and knocking on their door.
So, is this relatively easy to do, or does it actually take a criminal mind, so to speak, to think of these ideas, and do them?
Well, look, I don't think it takes a criminal mind. I do think
Okay.
it takes somewhat of a creative mind. I think that
Uh-huh.
it's not hard to do.
Yeah.
It's there is a method to it. What we call in intelligence, you've got to be both critical and you've got to be creative. So you need to be able to imagine, if you were
Yes.
a criminal or you were, involved in a certain circumstance, how you might
Yes.
use that to legitimize dirty money. And at the same time, you need to be very critical about the facts of the cases that are coming before you to make sure that, you're not
Yeah.
just going off on a tangent, because everything would look suspicious then. So it's about finding
Yes.
that balance between your critical and creative mind.
So, Aaron, what are some of the things that you look for? Some of the things that might trigger you to think, oh, that's a bit suspicious. Are there things that everyday people would notice, or are they only things that someone trained in that specific type of analysis, would find?
Look, I think it depends on what you're seeing. I liken
Yeah.
it to, in many ways, working like a doctor. So we have these
Yes.
things in intelligence or in law enforcement we call methodologies, or typologies
Yes.
of crime types. So
Yes.
it helps to really know those, to know how criminals are doing it and how they've done it in the past. At the same time, there's an element of common sense, as some would say, is not so common. But there is an
Yeah.
element of working through the problem as an art form as well. So, as you might go to a doctor and you might say, I've looked up on the internet, all of these symptoms that I've got. I might be cancer doctor, who's probably a bit more learned in the different diseases and the different symptoms, would
Yes.
say, okay, well, the symptoms you're describing could be a lot of things. Let's eliminate those before we go to cancer. So it's a bit
Yeah.
like that.
For our listeners, Aaron, can you, I recognize that you probably can't talk about specifics, but can you give us some idea of some of the bigger general cases that you've worked on and the outcomes?
Yeah, of course. So, one of my prouder cases, which did hit the
Yes.
media. So I worked on
Yeah.
a case, and I'll try to keep the details minimal so that my name
Yes,
doesn't
yes.
get out there.
Yes.
Was when I worked in the international intelligence exchange environment.
Yeah.
We were involved in. We received a request from a foreign intelligence agency about some subjects. They wanted certain information about, you know, where they were, what their movements were like, you know, how they, you know, movements between countries. So we looked at the subjects very carefully. We pulled together who they relate, who it looked like they were associating with, both in their finances and in what we call open source intelligence and other intelligence forms. We liaised with some partner agencies as well to try to get some extra information on them, which we couldn't get from our own sources. What happened was that we filed a report, we prepared a report, and we sent it back to our partner overseas. And then we later received feedback from the Australian Customs that the intelligence that we produced had actually led to the largest single seizure of cocaine in that country's history. So because we'd identified certain movements that weren't consistent with the information and intelligence that they were seeing on their side, they started looking at people they hadn't looked at before. And so customs knew they decided we're going to intercept them when they next come into the country. And they were able to work out their travel movements from the intelligence we provided. And in turn, they searched their belongings when they came into the country and they found the cocaine. So it's about piecing together a puzzle and working together in collaboration.
I was just going to say, it sounds like it's a very collaborative approach across countries and agencies that get the good results. Is that true to say?
Correct. Yeah. So money laundering is at its worst, it's an international crime. So the biggest and most prevalent risk to money laundering is what we call transnational crime organizations. So these are crime organizations that many of which are as big or if not bigger than some of our biggest corporations, operating, you know, across borders through some of which is through very large legitimate businesses using corrupt means in governments to help perpetrate their crime. And it's prevalent across the world. So it's not something that little old Australia can solve by itself. It's something that we have to do in partnership with other countries.
Okay. So you've been in this area of intelligence, and I wanted to then get on to what made you want to go out into your own business from having that wonderful and I guess very satisfying role in intelligence. Was there something that triggered in you that desire to branch out into your own business?
Yeah, so when I was at AUSTRAC, I used to observe, collect intelligence through what's called the Section 167 and the Section 49 powers. Now, what that allows AUSTRAC to do, you know, in simple terms, is whenever they're seeing something that doesn't make sense, that's reported to them by a bank or another financial institution, they can go to that institution and they can collect as much information as they need on that customer. And so when I was doing that, I was looking at what the banks and what some of our other reporting entities were collecting and what they were doing. And I was noticing that they were taking a very literal interpretation to what their obligations were. And in simple terms, what that means is they were looking at the legislation saying they have to do this. And they were literally just going tick box, tick box, tick box, rather than really engaging with the ways in which criminals might be exploiting their services and, you know, doing their due diligence. So to me, it was a problem that I wanted to help solve that led me on this path.
And so AML Risk Solutions was born, and out of that, your desire was to help other businesses understand what their responsibilities are around financial crime. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah. So with financial crime or anti-money laundering, in most jurisdictions in the world, there are laws that require what we call reporting entities in Australia. I'm not sure if that's the term used everywhere, to have a comprehensive anti-money laundering program. Now, you might have experienced that yourself when you go to a bank or you go to a remitter or you go to a jeweler or you go to various businesses where there is an ability to transfer value and you have to provide your ID when you sign up to their services and information about yourself.
Yes.
Well, a lot of people are like, you know, you hear jokes like, if someone's paying my credit card bill, you know, why do you ask for their ID? Just let them do it. And it's about more than that. It's about, you know, they're providing your IDs so that you can then conduct high level criminal checks behind the scenes and work out, you know, is your transaction legitimate? Are you buying this gold? Are you buying this jewelry, you know, for the purpose you're stating, or are you planning to melt it down and, you know, you know, then use that as a means to transfer value across jurisdictions, or, you know.
Okay.
So it's about that, really.
And it's not about that traditional idea that we might have about big bags of cash money, is it? Because this doesn't necessarily always mean or equate to cash, does it, Aaron?
No. There's something called value transfer is probably the better term.
Yes.
It can be, you know, money laundering can be perpetrated in any way in which you're able to move equivalent value from one place to another and make it look legitimate. And that's broad, very broad.
Yeah. So in terms of Australia's anti-money laundering laws, what does that mean for everyday businesses? Does it have an impact on everyday businesses, or is it only some?
So not all businesses fall in Australia under the what's called the Anti-Money Laundering and the Counter-Terrorism Financing Act. Only about 15,000 currently at the latest estimate. There is a push at the moment to bring businesses like lawyers, accountants, real estate agents, what we call professional facilitators of crime, under that act. Now, if that happens, it'll be about 100,000 businesses that would have reporting obligations under that act. Now,
that
seems a lot.
Well, I didn't realise that real estate agents, for example, didn't fall under that. So they're not required to report to anyone that Mr. X came in and paid $100,000 cash deposit on such and such a property. They're not now required to report that to anyone?
Not in Australia. In some jurisdictions they are. And it's something that we have been criticised about internationally on. I guess the issue is that it's quite an ask. It's quite an impost on the industry when we're asking them to take on these programs, because they're not light programs to take on. You need specialists.
No, I can
imagine.
You need
specialist expertise.
Yeah. Okay. So once you find a criminal organisation, and this is a pretty broad question, do you go for the organisation as a whole, or do you try to get the prime organiser/perpetrator?
You get whatever you can, to be honest. With intelligence, there's no such thing as completely everything, every form of knowledge, every form of information has value.
Yes.
Intelligence isn't just about providing information raw, though. It's about looking at the information and working out what is most valuable, and that's going to be circumstantial. So if you're getting a low-level street dealer, you know, maybe big scale, that's not, you know, you're not changing the world, but that low-level street dealer to a police officer conducting an investigation on a network, they may be an excellent source for intelligence. So sometimes your goal in intelligence is simply to build a bigger picture and pass it on to someone who may find that information or intelligence useful.
Okay. In thinking about cyber currency, do the same laws apply to cyber currency? So Bitcoin and there's a number of different cryptocurrencies available now. Is there the same sort of criminality involved in those exchanges, or have they made it easier for criminals to transfer that value and get a dollar in return?
So cryptocurrency and digital, I assume you mean cryptocurrency and not digital currency. So cryptocurrency is... No, that's okay. So what it is it's a problem worldwide, and some jurisdictions are dealing with it differently to Australia. Australia, I think, is quite progressive. We have brought cryptocurrency under the Act, so they do have reporting obligations to provide suspicious matter reports to AUSTRAC and, you know, cash transaction deposits and various forms of reporting. That's not the case in all jurisdictions. And in some jurisdictions, like I know in the United States, they're taking a somewhat different stance on regulating cryptocurrencies as seeing them as a form of security. So they are a problem. And jurisdictions, I must say, globally have been quite quick to start to try and find ways to regulate them and bring them into the Act.
Okay.
As to how that we can address this problem, that's anyone's guess. It's a difficult problem to overcome, cryptocurrency.
I was thinking about it this morning when I was preparing for the interview, and I'm like, so I find it difficult to get my head around cryptocurrency, and I wondered if criminals were heading more that way, or they're still pretty traditional in terms of cash and gold and assets, etc. Do you see that as an evolving level of crime?
It's certainly a problem. As to how prevalent it is, that's anyone's guess. Mm-hmm. In truth, cash is probably more of an issue than cryptocurrency, just because cryptocurrency does require a certain level of expertise to be able to execute effectively. And even with some of the most secretive coins like Monero and Verge, there's still ways to track them or to identify the movement through other means. Whereas cash is a little bit more difficult, to be honest. Yeah.
So what does that mean as we head towards a cashless society? Does that have implications as well?
I would say so. As to whether how quickly that is going to happen or in which jurisdictions it will happen, that's anyone's guess. But moving from cashless certainly would make, a significant impact on our ability to detect and disrupt organised crime groups.
Yeah. It would make it much more difficult, I would think. So the other thing that you were involved with was counter-terrorism financing, which was another aspect of your work that I found fascinating. How difficult is it to track the money in terrorism?
Very difficult. very difficult. Unlike money laundering, the amounts you're dealing with when you deal with terrorism financing can be very small. When we're talking about how much it costs to perpetrate an attack, in countries like Australia, where most of our, you know, attacks are being lone wolves, you know, it's the cost of buying a knife, or, you know, the cost of setting up an internet connection. Whereas in some other jurisdictions, like say in Indonesia, you know, where you have had in the past, quite advanced groups who are very comprehensively funded, where you've got training costs, you've got accommodation costs, you've got weapons costs. Mm. There's a lot more available to trace. Whereas in countries like Australia, where we're arguably it's much more difficult because of the level of regulation we have here, that it can be tricky, to be honest.
So when we think about financing terrorism, what have you found the reasons for doing this, and why? Like, why fund that? What's the ethos? What's the thinking behind funding terrorism attacks? Is it about power?
Well, that could be argued. I think from my perspective, and I guess broadly speaking, it comes down to beliefs and strong-held beliefs. So often with terrorism, and you know, I guess the famed one and the emerging, the famed one is Islamic terrorism, extremism, and the emerging risk of far right extremism that we've seen, you know, recently perpetrated in New Zealand. Is you know, very strong-held beliefs or convictions about the state of the world. in many ways that would lead someone to violence, to the need to want to perpetrate violence in order to change it. You know, those reasons, you know, they're broad and often they're very personal in most cases.
And that's a little bit harder to track, I'm guessing.
Yes. Well, financially speaking, yes. You know, one of the you know, ways in which you could probably more successfully track terrorism itself. So counterterrorism and counterterrorism financing, they're different, but there are very close similarities. So the way that terrorism's often tracked is through, you know, open source channels, social media, communications networks, really getting a good understanding of who the people or the actors are in that space, who they're involved with, how they're involved with them, looking for, and I don't like to use the word profiling, but indicators, looking for the common themes that sort of come about when someone becomes when they become radicalized. You're looking for those kinds of risk factors in certain people. You're monitoring and you're keeping an eye out for those risk factors. And when you do observe that, then you're considering the need for further surveillance and action. So I know it sounds very spooky when we talk about monitoring and surveillance. The truth is, you know, like in Australia, for instance, there's roughly about 2,000 people who work for our security intelligence organisation. They don't have the time or resources or interest to be looking at everyone.
Not a lot of people.
And to be honest, it's about focusing in on those who are most at risk of perpetrating these types of serious crimes or these types of serious threats to our national security. So it's nothing almost, nothing to be afraid of. As the former head of ASIO once said, he said that, we give corporations like Facebook and Google, we give them, you know, open permission to look into our lives, to sell us stuff every day, and no one bats an eye. But when, government agencies do it to save your life, you know, all of a sudden it's totalitarianism. Yeah. So it's, I agree that, you know, we do need to keep governments accountable. At the same time, it's about understanding, you know, the context behind why we need those powers.
Yes. And it is very much about keeping our Australian people safe, isn't it? Safe from any sort of crime. Now, we've been talking about the bigger, more well-known crimes, but you also tackle financial crime, generally speaking. So what does financial crime look like?
So financial crime as a term is quite broad. There's a distinct difference between what we would call white collar crime, which is what agencies like the Australian Security Investment Commission and the SEC in the USA would be more focused on, which is things like embezzlement, corporate misconduct, you know, corporate fraud to a degree, things that tax officers would be interested in, so tax evasion, and of course, money laundering and terrorism financing themselves. So, you know, money laundering itself is a crime. It's a separate crime on its own, one that often requires another predicate or another crime in order for it to be perpetrated.
So in other words, it would be a cocaine dealer selling his drugs and being paid in cash, and then that's when the money laundering comes in, because he can't just go and bank that cash. He's got to do something with it so that it's legitimate.
Well, I'd say so. It depends on the amount, but if he's making buckets of money, buckets of cash, laundering his money, at the very least, like if he starts banking that, you know, he's going to have the tax office of his country knocking on the door going, where's this money coming from? Where's our tax? So it's...
Aaron, is there a trigger amount that captures attention? Or is it different for every...
I wouldn't say there is a
specific... Because I have in my mind like $10,000, but I don't know where I got that from, so...
So that there's not a specific trigger amount. In most jurisdictions, okay, they have what's called thresholds for different types of, yes, reports. So the $10,000, mm-hmm, you're hearing would be what we call threshold transaction reports. So when you go to a bank, okay, or you go to a business that falls under the Act, and you make, yes, a payment of $10,000 or more, they have a legal obligation, uh-huh, to report that. However, there's exceptions to that rule. So if you're, right, you know, not completely daft and you're a criminal, you're going to know, yeah, about that. And so what you're going to do is practice a crime that we call structuring. And that's when they, right, start making deposits in smaller amounts, yeah, below the threshold, so that they can sort of try to avoid that reporting obligation so someone doesn't see that they're doing it. Okay. And that's suspicious in itself. And so that would get reported, sometimes even as a threshold, yeah, transaction report.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm thinking if you're regularly banking $9,995, that's still going to trigger some sort of alert that this is not looking particularly good, yeah?
Yeah, so absolutely. And so it's more than just, I guess, a single threshold. It's about, yes, like I said, symptoms. Looking for symptoms, looking, yes, for alerts, anything, yep, that could be worth looking at a bit further, and then monitoring, mm-hmm, testing, reviewing.
Yeah. Yeah. And across Australia, we have links between major agencies. So there's links between an employee and what they earn. The information goes from their employer to the tax office, and your financial situation is not as secret as you probably would like to think that it is, because those government interagencies all talk together, don't they?
It sounds very ominous when you put it that way, but yeah, that's true to a degree.
It's so for people who think that they are not, or who get upset about being tracked or traced or whatever, it's already happening. It's already happening unbeknownst to you in the background of your life. Does it impact on you? No. If you're doing the right thing, you've got nothing to be afraid of. If you're doing the wrong thing, however, damn straight, you should be caught by those processes that happen in the background for everyone. Isn't that right?
No, I completely agree. I think that, you know, we have laws, you know, in our countries to protect us from, yes, you know, and these aren't minor crimes. These are serious crimes. So yes. Yes. When we're talking about, you know, money laundering, I mean, it includes things like human impact crime. So you want a good justification. Yes. One thing that was very sobering for me to learn when I started, yes, in that profession was that in 2017, the International Labour Office said that, despite the fact that it's illegal in most countries, there's now more people living, yes, in slavery than any other time in human, yes, history. Now, yeah, the best and pretty much one of the best,
okay,
ways. No, it's not. And the thing is that the only way you're going to, you know, the reason why people get away with this is because of, yes, the inability for us to see everything, the inability for us to monitor everything. So I know, yes, people are afraid this happens or it's going to happen more. But the truth is that, you know, this is how these criminals get away. It needs to happen more. Yes.
Absolutely. If we have slavery in 2020, then we should be able to see what everyone's doing. And again, if you're not doing anything wrong, why are you concerned? Why are you concerned? We shouldn't have slavery in 2020. And if that means that we need to increase our government's ability to watch financial transactions so that they can catch those who perpetrate slavery across the world, then we should be doing it. From my perspective, I've got nothing to hide, so I don't actually have a problem if governments access my information, because I'm not doing anything wrong, so that's not an issue. If you are doing something wrong, then yeah, you should be scared. Because people like Aaron and Austrac, eventually, hopefully, they're going to catch you. I'm wondering still, in terms of we're thinking about slavery and the finance of slavery, it's beyond me how people could allow that to be part of their lives. Like, there would be people who know about this and they would know about it ongoingly, and they fail to do anything about it. So they're just as guilty of that crime of slavery, aren't they? By virtue of the fact that they're not telling guys like you, this is what's happening.
Well, yeah, and look, it is in most jurisdictions. There are crimes for knowledge of a crime, you know, it makes you an accessory or it makes you, you know, somehow involved. You know, in Australia, we have in some jurisdictions Good Samaritan, what they often call Good Samaritan laws, where if you do see a crime being perpetrated or you do see something, you do have an obligation to get involved. And you know, I think it's just common sense, and it comes down to, you know, the ethos of having a community is that, you know, we have police, we have governments, we have order, to put it in the words of one of America's founding fathers, because if men were angels, there would be no need for government. Sadly,
that's right.
Sadly, we're not all angels. And so, you know, we do need to have these systems in place to ensure that, you know, that people are doing what they should be doing in order to ensure a safe and prosperous society for all.
Yeah. Aaron, I want to get on now to your company and what you do. So I'd really love to understand how you help businesses understand these laws and financing and how you work with them to make sure they understand their obligations.
Yeah, of course. So it's very broad, depending on the needs of the business. With Australia's laws, like most of the laws globally, it's what's called risk-based compliance. So what that means is that your obligations are going to be on a case-by-case basis. As to how you structure or develop your financial crime program, well, that's largely up to the business as to how involved they want to be, who they want to allocate to do the work, how they want to structure it. Mm-hmm. So each business would have their own way of going about things. Hopefully following best practice models, which would then be overseen by a regulator. Now, in Australia, we're fortunate. AUSTRAC's what's called a dual regulator in that they are both an intelligence agency and they are the regulator to make sure that businesses are having appropriate risk-based compliance programs. In many jurisdictions globally, though, they're separate bodies. So it's... It's about how long is a piece of string. So it's really about getting to know your risks and understanding your own risk appetite.
So Aaron, can you give us an example of a typical sort of company / business that you would work with and what would you say, I don't know, an accountant, for instance?
Yeah, so I probably wouldn't work with accountants just yet because they don't fall under the Act, so they probably wouldn't want to spend money on me. But, you know, for instance, maybe they should, but, you know, it's up to them though. Of course, I wouldn't say no to a client.
Of course.
But in general, you know, say if I was working with a bank, for instance, a bank is probably going to have a much more comprehensive program and so would need a lot more services than, say, someone like a smaller remitter whose services could be as simple as I simply provide money transfers to these different jurisdictions. Now, with the remitter example, the service I would provide would probably be to help them build an anti-money laundering program that would allow them to understand both customer risks and product risks and jurisdictional risks. So the customer risks would be the types of customers, the amounts of money they're bringing, how to look into a customer's background and work out, you know, are they who they say they are, how to check ID to ensure it's not fraudulent, things like that.
How do you check ID to know that it's not fraudulent?
Again, that's a very broad question. Probably the best way would be something called independent verification. So if you make an ID that looks perfect, that, you know, you can't tell from just looking at it, it's very hard to fake the existence of the ID. with a government body or a government agency or another agency of some type. So a lot of mm-hmm. services operate in the background to confirm that a person really is who they say they are. Now, what some mm-hmm. criminals like to do to get around that yeah. is they'll actually steal yes. identity. So identity theft, your passport, uh-huh. for instance, your driver's license, that's valuable to a criminal because yes. that, what they can do, they can take that and then they can pretend that they're you and they can do all kinds of horrible yes. stuff in your name. So it's very important, you know, when you're dealing with this type of stuff, it's very important yes. That you're able to not just access a record to confirm that it exists, but that the person yes. looks like that they are who they say they are, that the story about who they are is consistent with what they're telling you. So you can't just take things as do a quick ID check and accept it as face value. You've got to look a little deeper if something's not looking right.
So, Aaron, what you're saying in that example used before of a firm that is in remittance, so you're saying that it's actually their responsibility to make sure that the IDs that they're being presented with are legitimate.
Correct. They've got a responsibility and obligation under the Act to ensure yeah. that they understand, or in the terms that are used in our Act, they know their customer. So they've got yes. an obligation to know their customer. And that doesn't just mean collect their ID and quickly verify it. It means
yeah.
get to know your customers and assess the ones who you consider are higher risk to your business and to the Australian community.
Uh-huh. So that would essentially follow through to any business that uses an identification process. They would need to be aware of these laws, yeah?
Any business that is required under the Act or provides a designated yeah. service. There are businesses that, you know, for instance, real estate, that have to ID customers for various reasons, that falls outside yeah. of what we'd call providing a designated service. But, you know, it depends, I guess, on the context of what business you're conducting and what risks you might expect to see.
Okay. So it definitely goes back to assessing your risk in the first instance, and that's where you and your company comes in?
Correct. Yeah. So what we do is we help businesses to understand their customer risks, so the risks of their greatest investment, to yes. teach them how to get to know their customers very well, help them understand uh-huh. their jurisdictional risks, or, you know, the risks mm-hmm. that are presented from different countries, help them understand how criminals might exploit their products and services, and help them yes. do that in a way that would satisfy a regulator, that they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another side to that. We help them do it in a way yeah. that's cost effective, because at the moment, uh-huh. the way businesses do it is they do broad base. They do all these checks like search Google and all of these types of assessments on every customer, yes. which they might not need to do on every single customer. And they think that that's right. the simple way to do it because it seems common sense. The truth is that, you know, if your some of those checks might be appropriate for some customers, but if you're doing that mm-hmm. for every customer, you're creating risks that allow criminals to very easily overcome what you're doing to detect their activity.
Yes, yes. So
and costing yourself a lot of money.
Yeah, because you might inadvertently be helping someone launder their money is what you're trying to avoid, isn't it, Aaron?
Yeah, 100%. In the majority of cases, most businesses mm-hmm. Involved in money laundering are either completely oblivious or very yeah. complacent about yeah. the risks of the laundering. And that's how criminals get away with it.
So the businesses, even if they don't know that they're laundering money, they are still under the law. Could be taken to trial for that, yeah?
Well, look, it depends on the circumstances.
Yes, okay.
In some cases, I would expect that, I mean, it's a hard crime to prosecute money laundering itself in Australia.
Yeah.
But it's, in some cases, I would say, yes, if there is criminal complicity, involved mm-hmm. in the money laundering. So say you're a mm-hmm. local remittance service and a criminal yes. comes to you and says, I want to use your service to transfer my drug money to this country and I want you to conceal it, if that can be proved, then I'd say certainly, you'd say no, but I'd say certainly there would be a potential for criminal charges. Whereas if you're not really sure and you're not really doing what you're supposed to, I mean, criminal charges, maybe not, but certainly very, very significant civil penalties.
Okay. So this is really important stuff for businesses that handle lots of money to know and know their risk under these laws, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And the fines are the biggest in the world. I mean, there have been money laundering fines that go into well into the billions. Aaron? Well, in Australia.
In the billions.
In the billions, yes. Yes.
Wow.
Globally. In Australia.
Really important stuff.
Oh, yes. Well, our largest fine, both our top two largest fines in Australian history were $700 million for Commonwealth Bank's breach of anti-money laundering laws and something along the lines of 50-something billion for TAB's breaches of money laundering laws. Globally, there's been some conglomerates of banks in America and Europe who've been fined many billions of dollars for their breaches. So it's not a small fine.
How did Commonwealth Bank not know that they were participating in money laundering? How does that happen?
So with Commonwealth Bank, the story was they had these automated ATM networks where you were able to deposit funds into ATMs that money wasn't being reported to anyone. So something went amiss, and for years an organised crime group was funneling money into these ATMs. They weren't being ID'd. None of this was being reported. And it got found because the federal police, what they were doing, they were following one of these crime groups, and they found out through surveillance that they had been depositing funds in these ATMs. They went to AUSTRAC and they said, we can't find this intelligence. Can you get it for us? And AUSTRAC goes, it's not there. So it was a ludicrous amount of breaches that they had perpetrated by not meeting their obligations.
So essentially they've gone and deposited great big lump sums of money and no one's, you would think that the individual banks that the ATMs were attached to would have been triggered, but that didn't happen?
No, unfortunately not. Now, it was not just the fine, but the reputational damage for the bank, because they, through their lack of, their lack of effort in properly, putting together this program, despite warnings from their regulator, they'd allowed this, quite significant crime group to get away with money laundering for a very long time.
Wow. That's amazing. Golly. Fascinating discussion, Aaron. I could keep talking. I'm aware that we're getting close to our time limit, and I really want to make sure that people know where to find you and how to find your company and your risk solutions and potential to work with them. So you're based in Melbourne, Australia, yeah?
Correct, yeah. So we're based in Melbourne, Australia. We have a website as well.
Which is can you tell everyone your website? Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. So it's www.amlrisksolutions.com.au. Now we do operate primarily in Australia. However, always open to doing business internationally.
Background in international as well, haven't you, Aaron?
Correct. Yeah. So I worked primarily in international intelligence exchange. So, and money laundering being a global crime, the risks don't change. Yes. They'd be more prevalent in some jurisdictions than others, but money laundering is money laundering no matter where you go.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if the headquarters of some crime syndicate is in, somewhere else and the crimes happen in Australia, and they happen within your business, you're still going to be caught up in that anyway, aren't you? But if they have a risk assessment from AML and you help them assess what risk they're likely to have, they're going to negate some of that worry about being caught up in something that they don't want to be caught up in.
Yeah, absolutely. And we work with large businesses, we work with small businesses. You know, these are, you know, to, if you're a small family business, you might think, well, what are the chances I'm going to get a large fine? Well, it's not just about the fine. It's also about the fact that, do you really want to be risking, you know, helping perpetrate these crimes? And, you know, what about the reputation to your business if a crime group is caught facilitating, you know, money laundering through your business? And what's going to happen if your name and your business is plastered all over the media as having been involved in that?
Correct. I mean,
that could be the death of you.
Yeah. Yeah, and business is tough enough at the moment. As Aaron can probably tell you, you're in lockdown in Melbourne, I assume, Aaron?
Yes, we are, unfortunately.
Which is not a great place to be, but thankfully we have the technology to connect and communicate, even if we can't physically go and see someone face-to-face. And I'm guessing that you're open to Zoom consultations and phone calls and all the other methods of technology we can use to engage with companies and corporations and assess their risk.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we will engage with you via various means. Obviously, if you are interested in our service, the best way to get in touch with us is to click the Inquire Now link on our website, and then we'll be in touch.
Yeah, fantastic. So Aaron's website again is aml.risksolutions. I'll let you tell it.
So www.amlrisksolutions, all one word, .com.au.
Fantastic. So, Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time to come on Radio Tony Everyday Business today. We've had a fascinating chat about financial crime in general terms and the implications for business around the risk of financial crimes and why they should be making sure that they're not at risk of being inadvertently involved in any of these financial crimes, because the implications could be considerably bad for you, your company and your business. And it's just actually now that you have heard about the solutions that AML offers, this is your opportunity to make sure that your business is okay. And I'm assuming that you use an audit process, Aaron, to advise companies and businesses about their risk?
An audit process is helpful. Usually it starts with a conversation about what products you offer, where you are doing business, so what countries you're doing business in, who your customers are, how much you know about your customers, and then we'd go from there. Sometimes it might require a full audit of your business. Sometimes it could just be as simple as a conversation as to what you, for us to work out as to what your risks might be. It really depends on how complicated your business is.
Yeah. So I'm assuming all that intelligence experience that you have would help you very quickly in a conversation know pretty much what some of the risks would be for different types of businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that's how I prefer to work, is to look at actually cases. So if I can even get into some of your transactions and take a look at some of your clients, you know, we can sometimes, you know, generally we can often catch a criminal through that. And it can be quite sobering when you realize, hey, this person could be a criminal.
Yes.
And I've been doing business with them for years and I've never thought it.
Yeah. Is that rather shocking for the businesses when they find that, Aaron?
I think so. It brings with it a certain amount of fear, particularly for larger businesses with all the very large fines that are out there for having perpetrated that. At the same time, you know, I understand that fear, but it was going to be there whether you found it or not. And to be honest, I'd prefer to find it and fix it before the regulator does. Or the police.
So your job is to find it before someone much more scary finds it. And that's your role.
Yeah, and that's
Aaron,
how it works.
We are completely out of time. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Radio Tony Everyday Business today to talk about a subject that I've found fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. Everybody, don't forget to get in contact with Aaron if you need to find out more about any financial crimes within Australia and across the wider world. Aaron, thank you so much. And everyone, thank you for listening today. This is your host, Tony Lontis, on Radio Tony, Everyday Business, and we'll be live again next week. Thanks, Aaron, and bye for now, everyone.
Thank you for watching and listening to Tony TV. For more inspirational stories, join us next week. Bye for now.